Part 2. Quotations. George Orwell. Reality exists in the human mind and nowhere else. This is the inevitable fate of the sentimentalists. All his opinions change into their opposites at the first brush of reality. It's the one thing they can't do. They can make you say anything, anything. But they can't make you believe it. They can't get inside you. And when memory failed and written records were falsified, when that happened, the claim of the party to have improved the conditions of human life had got to be accepted, because there did not exist, and never again could exist, any standard against which it could be tested. If all others accepted the lie which the party imposed, if all records told the same tale, then the lie passed into history and became truth. The creators outside looked from pig to man and from man to pig and from pig to man again, but already it was impossible to say which was which. The best books are those that tell you that which you already know. Freedom is the freedom to say that 2 + 2 = 4. If that is granted, all else follows. Above all, there was a belief in the revolution and the future. A feeling of having suddenly emerged into an era of equality and freedom. The masses never revolt of their own accord. And they never revolt merely because they are oppressed. Indeed, so long as they are not permitted to have standards of comparison, they never even become aware that they are oppressed. I sometimes think that the price of liberty is not so much eternal vigilance as eternal dirt. To die hating them, that was freedom. We are living in a world in which nobody is free, in which hardly anybody is secure, in which it is almost impossible to be honest and to remain alive. That the choice for mankind lie between freedom and happiness, and that, for the great bulk of mankind, happiness was better. War is peace. Freedom is slavery. Ignorance is strength. Power is in tearing human minds to pieces and putting them together again in new shapes of your own choosing. Man serves the interests of no creature except himself. Who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past. There are occasions when it pays better to fight and be beaten than not to fight at all. It is the same in all wars. The soldiers do the fighting, the journalists do the shouting, and no true patriot ever gets near a front-line trench, except on the briefest of propaganda tours. Before you can be sure whether you are genuinely in favor of socialism, you've got to decide whether things at present are tolerable or intolerable. And you have got to take up a definite attitude on the terribly difficult issues of class. all the war propaganda, all the screaming and the lies and hatred comes invariably from people who are not fighting. We know well that no one ever seizes power with the intention of relinquishing it. One does not establish a dictatorship in order to safeguard a revolution. One makes the revolution in order to establish the dictatorship. No one believes more firmly than Comrade Napoleon that all animals are equal. He would be only too happy to let you make your decisions for yourselves. But sometimes you might make the wrong decisions, comrades, and then where would we be? In order to hate imperialism, you've got to be part of it. It is this fear of a supposedly dangerous mob that makes nearly all intelligent people conservative in their opinions. Power is not a means, it is an end. All animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others. Man is the only creature that consumes without producing, yet he is the lord of all animals. He sets them to work, he gives back to them the bare minimum that will prevent them from starving, and the rest he keeps for himself. It is curious how people take it for granted that they have a right to preach at you and pray over you as soon as your income falls below a certain level. For after all, what is there behind it except money? Money for the right kind of education, money for influential friends, money for leisure and peace of mind, money for trips to Italy. Money writes books, money sells them. Give me not righteousness, O Lord. Give me money. Only money. Poverty frees them from ordinary standards of behavior, just as money frees people from work. You can possess money, or you can despise money. The one fatal thing is to worship money and then fail to get it. The mass of the rich and the poor are differentiated by their incomes and nothing else. And the average millionaire is only the average dishwasher dressed in a new suit. If you set yourself to it, you can live the same life, rich or poor. You can still keep on with your books and your ideas. You just got to say to yourself, I'm a free man in here, and you're all right. In practice, nobody cares whether work is useful or useless, productive or parasitic. The sole thing demanded is that it shall be profitable. In all the modern talk about energy, efficiency, social service, and the rest of it, what meaning is there except get money, get it legally, and get a lot of it? Money has become the grand test of virtue. Faith, hope, money. Only a saint could have the first two without having the third. Within certain limits, it is actually true that the less money you have, the less you worry. Looking at the world as a whole, the drift for many decades has not been towards anarchy, but rather towards the reimposition of slavery. We have now sunk to a depth at which the reinstatement of the obvious is the first duty of all intelligent men. The object of persecution is persecution. The object of torture is torture. And the object of power is power. It is not possible for any thinking person to live in a society such as ours without wanting to change it. The existing social order is a swindle, and its cherished beliefs mostly delusions. Political language, and with variations, this is true of all political parties, from conservatives to anarchists, is designed to make lies sound truthful and murder respectable, and to give an appearance of solidarity to pure wind. It occurs to me that one defeats the fanatic precisely by not being a fanatic oneself, but on the contrary, by using one's intelligence. People can foresee the future only when it coincides with their own wishes, and most grossly obvious facts can be ignored when they are unwelcome. A world in which it is wrong to murder an individual civilian, and right to drop 1,000 tons of high explosives upon a residential area, sometimes makes me wonder whether this Earth of ours is not a loony bin made use of by some other planet. Think of life as it really is. Think of the details of life. And then think that there is no meaning in it, no purpose, no goal except the grave. Surely, only fools or self-deceivers or those whose lives are exceptionally fortunate can face that thought without flinching. Bully worship, under various disguises, has become a universal religion. And such truisms as that a machine gun is still a machine gun, even when a good man is squeezing the trigger, have turned into heresies which it is actually becoming dangerous to utter. I write. Highly civilized human beings are flying overhead, trying to kill me. Each generation imagines itself to be more intelligent than the one that went before it, and wiser than the one that comes after it. This is an illusion. The really frightening thing about totalitarianism is not that it commits atrocities, but that it attacks the concept of objective truth. It claims to control the past as well as the future. None of this is real. The point is that we are all capable of believing things which we know to be untrue. And then, when we are finally proven wrong, we twist the facts so as to show that we were indeed right. If liberty means anything at all, it means the right to tell people what they do not wish to hear. He is a slave with a semblance of liberty, which is worse than the most cruel slavery. You just have to say to yourself, look, I'm a free man in here. He
tapped his forehead. And you're all right. No one can get up much enthusiasm for a government which puts you in jail when you open your mouth. Like a drug. Machines are useful, dangerous, and habit-forming. There was, I believe, a belief in the revolution and the future, a feeling of having suddenly emerged into an era of equality and freedom. In every one of those little stucco boxes, there's some poor bastard who's never free except when he's fast asleep and dreaming. The fallacy is to believe that under a dictatorial government, you can be free inside. One wonders if the man in the street will ever feel that freedom of the mind is as important and as much in need as being defended as his daily bread. What is needed is the right to print what one believes to be true, without having to fear bullying or blackmail from any side. The most effective way to destroy people is to deny and obliterate their own understanding of their history. Who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past. Doublethink means the power of holding two contradictory beliefs in one's mind simultaneously and accepting both of them to be true. In the face of pain, there are no heroes. Power is in tearing down human minds to pieces and putting them together again in new shapes of your own choosing. The very essence of being human is that one does not seek perfection. Choice for mankind lies between freedom and happiness, and for the great bulk of man, happiness is better. People sleep peacefully in their beds at night only because rough men stand ready to do violence on their behalf. On the whole, human beings want to be good, but not too good, and not quite all the time. Men can only be happy when they do not assume that the object of life is happiness. you can feel that staying human is worthwhile, even when it can't have any result whatsoever, you've beaten them. A people that elect corrupt politicians, imposters, thieves, and traitors are not victims, but accomplices. Man is the only creature that consumes without producing. He does not give milk, nor does he lay eggs. He is too weak to pull the plow. He cannot run fast enough to catch a rabbit. Yet he is the lord of all animals. He sets them to work. He gives back to them the bare minimum that will prevent them from starving, and the rest, of course, he keeps for himself. The creatures outside looked from pig to man, and from man to pig, and from pig to man again, but already it was impossible to say which was which. Man is the only real enemy we have. Remove man from the scene, and the root cause of hunger and overwork is abolished. It's curious, isn't it, that people take for granted that they have the right to preach at you and pray over you as soon as your income falls below a certain level. The stars are a free show. It don't cost anything to use your eyes. The mass of the rich and the poor are differentiated by their incomes and nothing else. And the average millionaire is only the average dishwasher dressed in a new suit. In practice, nobody cares whether work is useful or useless, productive or parasitic. The sole thing demanded is that it shall be profitable. What can you do, thought Winston, against the lunatic who is more intelligent than yourself, who gives your arguments a fair hearing, or simply persists in his lunacy? Until they become conscious, they will never rebel. And until after they have rebelled, well, they will never become conscious. If you loved someone, you loved him. And when you had nothing else to give, you gave him that love. Power is tearing human minds to pieces and putting them together again in new shapes of your own choosing. It's a beautiful thing, the destruction of words. Of pain, you can only wish one thing, that it should stop. Nothing in the world was so bad as physical pain. In the face of pain, there are no heroes. There was truth, and there was untruth. And if you clung to the truth,
even against the whole world, you were not mad. Sanity is not at all statistical. Your worst enemy is your own nervous system. At any moment, tension inside you is liable to translate itself into some visible symptom. You know it struck him that in moments of crisis, one is never really fighting against an external enemy, but always against one's own body. On the battlefield, in the torture chamber, or on a sinking ship, the issues that you are fighting for are always forgotten, because the body swells up until it fills the universe. And even when you are not paralyzed by fright or screaming with pain, life is a moment-to-moment struggle against hunger or cold or sleeplessness, against a sour stomach or even an aching tooth. Orthodoxy means not thinking, not needing to think. Orthodoxy is unconsciousness. Confession is not betrayal. What you say or do doesn't matter. Only feelings matter. They could make me stop loving you. Now that would be real betrayal. If thought corrupts language, language can also corrupt thought. The Ministry of Peace concerns itself with war. The Ministry of Truth with lies. The Ministry of Love with torture. And the Ministry of Plenty with starvation. These contradictions are not accidental. The essential act of war is destruction. Not necessarily of human lives, but of the products of human labor. War is a way of shattering to pieces, or pouring into the stratosphere, or sinking into the depths of the sea, materials which might otherwise be used to make the masses too comfortable, and hence, in the long run, too intelligent. We do not merely destroy our enemies, we change them. The end? Well, the end was contained in the beginning. The consequences of every act are included in the act itself. I've always thought it curious that the sky is the same for everybody. And the people under the sky were also very much the same everywhere, all over the world, hundreds or thousands of millions of people, just like this. People ignorant of one another's existence, held apart by walls of hatred and lies, and yet almost exactly the same. People who had never learned to think, but were storing up in their hearts and bellies and muscles the power that would one day overturn the world.
He felt as though he was wandering in the forests of the sea bottom, lost in a monstrous world where he himself was the monster. He was alone. The past was dead, and the future unimaginable. In the face of pain, there are no heroes. I enjoy talking to you. Your mind appeals to me. It resembles my own mind, except that you happen to be insane. Quotations. Animal Farm. No animal shall kill any other animal without just cause. Weak or strong, clever or simple, we are all brothers. The answer to every problem, every setback is, I will work harder. The Seven Commandments. Whatever goes on two legs is an enemy. Whatever goes on four legs or has wings is a friend. No animal shall wear clothes. No animal shall sleep in a bed. No animal shall drink alcohol. No animal shall kill any other animal. All animals are equal. Several of them would have protested if they could have found the right arguments. He would say that God had given him a tail to keep the flies off, but that he would have sooner had no tail and no flies. There, comrades, is the answer to all of our problems. It is summed up in one single word, man. If Comrade Napoleon says it's right, it must be right. Please remember also that in fighting against man, we must not come to resemble him. Even when you have conquered him, do not adopt his vices. The cat joined the re-education committee and was very active in it for some days. She had seen one dog sitting on a roof, talking to some sparrows who were just out of her reach. She was telling them that all animals are now comrades, and that any sparrow who chose could come and perch on her paw. But the sparrows kept their distance. Never listen when they tell you that man and animals have similar interests. That the prosperity of one is the prosperity of the others, it is all lies. Man serves the interest of no creature except himself. All that year, the animals worked like slaves, but they were happy in their work. They grudged no effort or sacrifice.
well aware that everything they did was for the benefit of themselves and those of their kind who would come after them, and not for a pack of idle, thieving human beings. This work was strictly voluntary. But any animal who was not there would have his rations cut by half. Windmill or no windmill, he said, life would go on as it had always done. Badly. Somehow, it seemed as though the farm had grown richer without making the animals themselves any richer. Except, of course, for the dogs and the pigs. Some of the animals remembered, or thought they remembered, a sixth commandment which decreed, "No animal shall kill any other animal," although no one cared to mention it within the hearing of the pigs or dogs. It was felt that the killings which had taken place recently did not somehow square with this. "Never mind the milk, comrades," cried Napoleon, placing himself in front of the buckets. "That will all be attended to. The harvest is more important. Comrade Snowball will lead the way. I shall follow in a few minutes, of course. Forward, comrades, the hay is waiting." So the animals trooped down to the hayfield to begin the harvest, and when they came back in the evening, it was noticed that the milk had disappeared. Four young porkers in the front row uttered shrill squeaks of disapproval, and all four of them sprang to their feet and began speaking at once. But suddenly, the dogs sitting around Napoleon let out deep, menacing growls, and the pigs fell silent and sat down again. Then the sheep broke out into a tremendous bleating of four legs good, two legs bad, which went on. The result of preaching totalitarian doctrines is to weaken the instinct by means of which free people know what is or is not dangerous. One does not say that a book ought not to have been published merely because it is a bad book. After all, acres of rubbish are printed daily, and no one bothers a thing about it. The creatures outside looked from pig to man, from man to pig, and from pig to man again, but already it was impossible to say which was which. Man is the only creature that consumes without producing. He does not give milk, he does not lay eggs, and he is too weak to pull the plow. He cannot run fast enough to catch rabbits. Yet he is the lord of all the animals. He sets them to work. He gives back to them the bare minimum that will prevent them from starving, and the rest he keeps for himself. No one believes more firmly than Comrade Napoleon that all animals are equal. He would be only too happy to let you make your decisions for yourselves. But sometimes you might make the wrong decisions, comrades, and then where would we all be? They had come to a time when no one dared to speak his mind, when fierce growling dogs roamed everywhere, and when you had to watch your comrades torn to pieces after confessing to shocking crimes. But the luxuries of which Snowball had once taught the animals to dream, the stalls with electric lights and hot and cold running water, and the 3-day work week, were no longer talked about. Napoleon had denounced such ideas as contrary to the spirit of animalism. The truest happiness, he said, lie in working hard and living frugally. It had become usual to give Napoleon credit for every successful achievement and every stroke of good luck. You would often hear one hen remark to another, "Under the guidance of our leader, Comrade Napoleon, I have laid 5 eggs in 6 days." Or 2 cows, enjoying a drink at the pool, would exclaim, "Thanks to the leadership of Comrade Napoleon, how excellent this water tastes." The distinguishing mark of man is the hand, the instrument with which he does all of his mischief. "Comrades," he cried, "you do not imagine, I hope, that we pigs are doing this in a spirit of selfishness and privilege. Many of us actually dislike milk and apples. I myself dislike them. Our sole object in taking these things is to preserve our health for your best interests." At first, they pretended to laugh and scorn the idea of animals managing a farm for themselves. The whole thing would be over in a fortnight, they said. They put it about that the animals on the manor farm, they insisted on calling it the manor farm, they would not tolerate the name animal farm, were perpetually fighting amongst themselves, and were also rapidly starving to death. When time passed, and the animals had eventually not starved to death, Frederick and Pikington changed their tune and began to talk of the terrible wickedness that now flourished on Animal Farm. It was given out that the animals there practiced cannibalism, tortured one another with red-hot horseshoes, and had their females in common. This was what came of rebelling against the laws of nature, Frederick and Pikington said. But a few days later, Muriel, reading over the 7 commandments to herself, noticed that there was yet another of them which the animals had remembered incorrectly. They had thought that the 5th commandment was, "No animal shall drink alcohol." But there were 2 words that they had forgotten. Actually, the commandment read, "No animal shall drink alcohol to excess." Whenever anything went wrong, it became usual to attribute it to Snowball. If a window was broken, or perhaps a drain was blocked, someone was certain to say that Snowball had come out in the night and done it. And when the key of the store shed was lost, well, the whole farm was convinced that Snowball had thrown it down the well. Curiously, they went on believing this after the mislaid key was found under a sack of meal. There was nothing upon which they could compare their present lives. They had nothing to go upon except Squealer's list of figures, which invariably demonstrated that everything was getting better and better and better. Can you not understand that liberty is worth more than just ribbons? Man is the only real enemy we have. Remove man from the scene, and the root cause of hunger and overwork is abolished forever. If liberty means anything at all, it means the right to tell people what they do not wish to hear. I saw a little boy, perhaps 10 years old,
driving a huge cart horse along a narrow path, whipping it whenever it tried to turn. It struck me that if only such animals became aware of their strength, we should have no power over them, and that men exploit animals in much the same way as the rich exploit the poor. Besides, in those days there had been slaves, and now they were all free, and that made all the difference.
And remember, comrades, your resolution must never falter. No argument must lead you astray. Rebellion meant a look in the eyes, an inflection in the voice, at most, an occasional whispered word. But the proles, if only they could somehow become conscious of their own strength, they would have no need to conspire. They needed only to rise up and shake themselves like a horse shaking off flies. Is it not crystal clear, then, comrades, that the evils of this life of ours spring from the tyranny of human beings? Only get rid of man, and the produce of our labor would be our own. Almost overnight we could become rich and free. What then must we do? Why work night and day, body and soul, for the overthrow of the human race? This is my message to you, comrades. Rebellion. I have no wish to take life. Not even human life. Remember this, comrades. No animal must ever live in a house, or sleep in a bed, or wear clothes, or drink alcohol, or smoke tobacco, or touch money, or engage in any sort of trade. All the habits of man are evil. And above all, no animal must ever tyrannize his own kind. Weak or strong, clever or simple, we are all brothers. No animal must ever kill any other animal, as all animals are equal. They were able to forget that their bellies were empty, at least part of the time. The fact is, they were always cold, and usually hungry as well. Donkeys live a long time. None of you, I dare say, has ever seen a dead donkey. Such were their thoughts, though she lacked the words to express them. War is war. No animal in England is free. The flag was green, Snowball explained, to represent the green fields of England, while the hoof and horn signified the future republic of the animals, which would arise when the human race had finally been overthrown. Little known facts about George Orwell. As a child, Orwell was known as a prankster. He disliked many of the schools he went to, and was even expelled from his crammar school, which he attended before joining the Indian Imperial Police. Various biographies of the author describe how he pulled pranks that got him into various degrees of trouble. They include sending a dead rat to the town surveyor, making up songs about his school's headmaster, and falsely replying to advertisements in newspapers. He got arrested on purpose. During his time in Paris and London, Orwell investigated the poorest areas of the two cities. He sought out the darker districts of London, and one time got so drunk he was arrested on purpose and was able to learn about prison. He drank a great deal and then made a scene. Now, he spent only 48 hours in custody before being released, This is one of the many experiences that helped him inform his memoir, Down and Out in Paris and London. By the time of his death, he could speak 7 different languages. From a young age, Orwell learned French, interestingly, from Aldous Huxley, the author of Brave New World. While living in India and working for the Imperial Police, he taught himself Burmese until he was fluent and able to easily converse with the locals in the highest of dialects. He also learned Greek, Spanish, as well as Latin and German. Orwell was charged with treason in Spain. During the period of the Spanish Civil War, Orwell lived and fought against Franco in Spain. He arrived at 33 years old with the intention of writing about the conflict, but he soon joined in with the fighting, becoming a part of a Republican militia against fascism. While fighting, he was shot in the neck by a sniper. By the time he was charged with treason, he had already left the country with his wife. He coined numerous words still in use today. It's a well-known fact that 1984 and Animal Farm have served as inspiration for generations of writers. But some of the words used in 1984, as well as others he created for his essays, are still used today. One of the most prominent of these is Cold War, which came from his essay, You and the Atom Bomb, published in 1945. It was written soon after the bombs were dropped on Japan during World War II. Other words that are tied to his name and his works of literature are Memory Hole, Orwellian, Big Brother, Thought Crime, and Thought Police. Orwell tried to inform on communist sympathizers in England. In 1949, Orwell sent the Foreign Office a list of names of those he believed were secretly trying to advance the communist cause. He believed that it was part of his duty as a citizen to inform the government of the threat he thought that these people posed. He knew that such a list could be dangerous, especially as many of the names were likely innocent. He worked for the BBC. One of George Orwell's steadiest jobs was as a radio commentator for a news program on BBC Radio. His job, talks producer, was similar to that of a propagandist during the Second World War. Orwell explained that he hated this work and felt disingenuous as he broadcasted to the Indian subcontinent. He nearly drowned in 1947. During the period that he was writing 1984 while living in Scotland, Orwell nearly drowned on a boating trip. He took his son, as well as a niece and nephew, out in the Gulf in the western part of the country. There at the site of what is the world's 3rd largest whirlpool, the small boat capsized. Luckily, everyone survived. He had tattoos on his knuckles. During his youth, when he served for 5 years with the Indian Imperial Police, Orwell got small tattoos on each of his knuckles. The tattoos were simple, small blue shapes that were generally round. Now it is not entirely clear why he got them, but some scholars believe that the tattoos were part of a Burmese superstition that suggested that they'd protect the wearer from being shot. Other writers pose a different theory, that Orwell got them simply to stand out amongst the other soldiers. He was noted throughout his time with the police as a loner, set apart by his desire to spend his time reading and writing. He struggled with and eventually died from tuberculosis. Unfortunately, like many writers, Orwell had a sickly youth that continued into his adulthood. In the 1940s, when there wasn't a widespread cure for the disease, his TB got much worse. He died in 1950 after attempting to use a drug that resulted in terrible side effects. How he got that name. Born Eric Arthur Blair, he assembled his now infamous pen name by patriotically calling on St. George and the River Orwell. His conflicted days as a policeman. Nudged into becoming a member of the British Imperial Police Force by his father, he chose a posting in Burma and only returned to England after contracting a tropical disease, fatal breakdown fever. That was when he decided to become a writer. During his time in Burma, he was able to speak Burmese fluently with all the natives in all dialects. Orwell's socialist days. A staunch socialist who traveled to the north of England's industrial coalface and documented the hardships of the working classes for his landmark work, The Road to Wigan Pier. His interviews for the book saw him placed under surveillance. Ironically, Orwell's dystopian surveillance-tinged masterpiece 1984 was released 1 year later in 1949. He was a great lover of fine pubs. In 1946, Orwell penned an essay on his dream pub for London's Evening Standard entitled The Moon Underwater, listing the 10 elements his favorite boozers would have to possess, including the availability of aspirin behind the bar. Today, a handful of UK-based pubs ran by J.D. Weatherspoon go by the same name as his essay. The writer came from a lauded background. Although he became a champion of working classes, Orwell himself was from high stock. His great-great-grandfather, Charles Blair, was married to Gentry, while he enjoyed a relatively comfortable childhood, winning scholarships to both Wellington and Eton colleges. It was at Eton where Orwell once practiced black magic on a wax effigy of a school bully. After the young man broke his leg, developed leukemia, and died, Orwell reportedly spent the rest of his life believing that he'd killed him with the voodoo spell.